Domino, Domino, on the spot a few blacks behind you. Domino, Domino, on the spot a few blacks behind you.
Hello, everyone. I am your host, Robert Stevens, and this is the Black Work Experience Podcast. As you may know, I started this podcast because I was tired of being the only black male or one of the few black people at my organization. This can be crazy. I was constantly called upon to speak for the black experience or expected to do the emotional labor after blatantly racist things occurred. This is heavy, and it left me feeling fragile, unappreciated, and in need of a change. I began to ask my friends if they ever experienced being the only one or one of the few people of color at their job and the impact it had upon them. We discussed what it felt like to experience microaggressions and not have a friend or ally to lean on. Balancing the thin line between needing your coins and not being tokenized is never easy. The Black Work Experience explores the intersection between race, class, and privilege in America and in the workforce. We tell the stories of those who paved and are currently paving the way. As people of color gain more institutional, political, and economic power, we often find ourselves surrounded by people who do not look like us, talk like us, or even think like us. This podcast discusses what it's like to walk in the shoes of those who feel alone. I fully recognize that not all black people think alike. The stories we share on this podcast may seem foreign to you and your experience. However, a lot of black people experience microaggressions daily, and we need an outlet. This is your outlet. I want you to know that you are not alone. This podcast is for all people, but we focus heavily on black people. I want you to know that you're not the only one experiencing microaggressions, otherness at work, and potential loneliness. If you identify with majority culture, listen to the podcast. Think about how you can help your black colleagues when your coworker talks over them or runs to the manager instead of having a difficult conversation or even calls them intimidating. Lean in, listen, and learn. That's what we're asking of you. Guess what time it is? You guessed it, it's mail time. We had a lot of submissions for mail time this week. Ask you to please keep them coming. You can send us your story via Instagram at BWEPod, on Twitter at BWEPodcast, and email blackworkexperiencepod@gmail.com. This week's mail time is a doozy. I'm gonna read it out for you all. When I was on staff, our organization was having trouble investing teachers in their new goal setting framework because it felt kind of dense and not very connected to students and the day-to-day work of a teacher. I'm a fairly gifted storyteller and could see a way to simplify and present the framework so that it was more human and easier to digest. No one wanted a job of this at our team meeting because it was perceived as a cultural minefield. So it was assigned to me. In prep, I spent hours and hours talking to other teachers, parents, students, and put together a visual narrative. And then I got up and gave a TED-style presentation at our training to teachers and over 200 students. And at the end, the entire organization stood up and clapped and cheered. They were so fired up. People still reference that experience to me to this day and how it inspired them and changed their perspective on the power of co-creating horizons with students. I walked off the stage feeling like I had created something that people connected with and felt proud of myself because I allowed myself to be seen and I don't generally like to be in the spotlight. And then the leader of our organization came up to me, a Latina woman. She didn't say thank you or you did a great job. Instead, she said, "It's not that I would ever want you to shine less brightly. I just want you to think about how it makes others on your team feel when you shine that brightly." And then she gestured to several of my white female colleagues. It's been many, many years since this, and I've gone on to many other forums, and yet I still hear her words in my head each time I do something visible that I feel proud of. Man, that resonated with me. It really made me think about the power of words. It made me think about how it's been years since this individual did that presentation. And every time she does something amazing, she harkens back to that moment. The power of words. Words are so important. They can set a reality. They can tear down walls. And they can also build barriers that take years and years to demolish. If you all are listening to this podcast, you're working with people of color, make sure you remember how powerful words can be and choose to uplift them rather than tear them down. Thank you all.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I'm excited because we have Donald Boone on the line with us today. Donald, can you say hello?
Hello, hello. What's going on?
What's going on, brother? What's going on? Super excited to have you, man. I know you're doing some amazing things. I see you all over Instagram. I know that you're flourishing. Let's jump right in there. We got the housekeeping out of the way, right? So let's just jump
definitely.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Donald, who are you? Where are you from? And, yeah, what are you doing? What are you working on? Let the people know who you are.
No, definitely, man. So first of all, thanks for having me. I'm definitely honored. It's a privilege anytime I get an opportunity to shed a little bit more light on my story specifically. So when in terms of defining myself, I like to kind of think of myself in a couple of ways. First and foremost, a man of God. Secondarily, a proud husband and father of two beautiful children. I've got a daughter that's 3 and a son that turns 2 in September. And then also, during my 9-to-5, I work at Amazon in Seattle, Washington. So those are probably the 3 first and foremost pillars. And on top of that, just in case I didn't have any more time for anything else, man, an entrepreneur, have been my entire life, I think, you know, part-time for the first few years of my life. While I tried to keep it buried, you know, and keep it as something that I did on the side, and sort of as the years go on, and I'm sure we'll get to it pretty soon here, is something that's definitely overtaken me with passion over the last few years.
Certainly. Well, thank you for sharing that. Your journey. Tell us where you started. You know, what made you get into, you know, being an entrepreneur? What about that influences you and motivates you? It pushes your buttons.
Yeah, for sure. So humble beginnings. I'm from Sea Pleasant, Maryland, which is right outside of Washington, D.C., literally, you know, five minutes and walk into the D.C. line. And for anybody in that area who's familiar with that area, knows a lot of basketball players come out of that area, but what you don't see is a lot of engineers come out of that area. And I was fortunate to have a mom who really looked over us and made sure that she did everything right to position us the way that she wanted to, just to make sure that we had a viable future. But it was tough. You know, growing up was it was a rough neighborhood. For a couple of reasons. There was definitely violence, but I think more than anything, there weren't really a lot of role models doing things outside of sports and drugs. So, you know, those were the two primary examples that I saw. Unfortunately, I had a father who was present in the home, physically present, but not mentally present. So mentally present, lacking a mental presence from a standpoint of support. So, you know, he was there. So really the role models that I was forced to cling to were like older brothers and older friends. And it was something that was always inside of me. And I think because we didn't come from or didn't have a lot of money growing up, it turned into a thing where I really started to figure out how can I make it easier for me and my family in the future, my prospective family, to do well. So I started figuring out ways to try to hustle. So I was that kid in the school, man. My mom would buy a big bag of candy at Sam's Club. Mm-hmm. I'd take it, bag it up, take it to high school, and I start hustling candy bars, man. Snickers, you know, lollipops, whatever. You name it, I was trying to sell it if it wasn't in the vending machine. It got to the point where my mom actually made, like, these bumpin' chicken and dumplings, right? And I get mm-hmm. to the lunch table. I let a couple people try some of the chicken and dumplings. Like, dude, I pay you for this. So I'm like, of course. So the next day I walk up with a second bowl of chicken and dumplings. So I'm even, you know, slinging my mom's cooking as well. So that was something that was always embedded in me. I think it came from my economic status, but it's also one of the things that I think that you're born into. So I think both circumstance and really just the way that I was brought up really lend it to sort of that passion as an entrepreneur.
Mm. I think that your story is very similar to a lot of young people who may grow up in inner city area stories, like seeing that growing up in Seat Pleasant. You know, I have the privilege and the pleasure of living not too far from Seat Pleasant. I actually spend a lot of time there, so I know exactly where you come from. And this is so interesting to see the journey that people take from where they begin to where they end up. And I know you mentioned living in Seattle, Washington, right? And you know, I'm not sure. Yep. I've never been to Seattle, but I can imagine that Seattle is I don't know. How diverse is Seattle? Let me just ask you that one.
I was going to say, it's probably a lot of what you think about. I mean, you know, Seattle's one of them places you've probably never met a person from Seattle just in your everyday life. It's a beautiful, beautiful city. But not beautiful because it's diverse, that's for sure. I think the exact population, I don't want to lie, but it's in the single digits from an African-American population standpoint, and it's only getting worse as the years go on, and certainly made worse by the tech industry. So it's one of those things where I'm a benefactor, but it also impacts my people in adverse ways. So like a lot of, you know, major metropolitan areas, a lot of Black folks are getting pushed to the outskirts of the city. So it's one of those places outside of work. I'm lucky to find or run across another Black person in the day before, from the time I leave my home to the time I come back. I might go a full work day without seeing a Black person in any capacity. That's mailroom, you know, guy at the laundromat, whatever, you name it. You know, I'm probably not seeing the trash guy or trash mm-hmm. woman. You know, I'm just really not a lot of Black folks in the area. So that certainly had an impact on me and my family and how we feel about the city. We enjoy being in somewhere so unique and so different, but it's certainly not without the downside of not being able to see our people and my kids not being able to grow up in neighborhoods where they can see kids that look like them. So that definitely has an impact on us. I think to Seattle's credit, they recognize it, and a lot of the locals wish it were better. It's one of the first things that they say out of their mouths is, hey, man, I wish it were more diverse. You'll see Black Lives Matter signs everywhere. So that's the upside, but definitely a struggle every day.
Certainly. So you think about the climate in Seattle. You think about you being an African-American man, and we jump right into this. What I think I want to know is, like, how has your racial identity impacted your professional career? You know, do you think it's stymied opportunities, or do you think it's buoyed opportunities for you?
Man, that's an amazing question. I think from a couple of ways, right? I think originally, in, you know, coming right out of school, I think it was definitely helpful in getting me in the door from a standpoint of, if you're qualified, certain companies are large enough where they're getting a lot of regulatory pressure to go out and hire minorities. So it's definitely not lost on me that I'm a benefactor from that standpoint. You know, I needed to be smart, right? So engineer, you know, I graduated with a 3.5 mechanical engineering degree from North Carolina A&T, Aggie Pride. And I graduated to go work for a company called ExxonMobil, and they needed to hire people of color. That definitely helps their bottom line. So that definitely helped me to get in the door. However, once in the door, it's the impact that my color had, I think, adversely, from a standpoint of, and one of my mentors at the company and I talked about this is we thought and he felt, you know, he retired ExxonMobil. He felt that management was less likely to take risk on African Americans than they were with other whites within the organization, primarily white males versus black males. We didn't get the same level of opportunity and risk that was associated with investing in a young talent to promote them into a role that they were less qualified for. There was always a sense that I needed to be overqualified to get the job, where my white counterpart might be able to get into a role a couple of years ahead of time, even if the two of us were performing at a similar state. So, you know, it started to, at first, I never really thought about it. It was one of those things where, look, man, I'm confident I can do it. I'll be good. And then I had a conversation with a different mentor, a female mentor, and I had facial hair. So I walk into her office one day, really good conversation. We talked for about 30 minutes about career development, progression, and how she can help me along my career. And then she sits down and she says, you know, Donald, there's one other thing I wanted to talk to you about. I'm like, sure, what's going on? She says, has anybody talked to you about your facial hair? I'm like, not really. Why do you say? She's like, if you look around, if you look at our leadership, if you look at the top of the corporate structure, does anyone have facial hair? And I said, well, no, I don't see anybody with facial hair, but I also don't see anybody that looks like me. I don't see any men, any black men that probably struggle with ingrown hairs like I do. And she proceeded to kind of lean in on me a little bit and pressure me into cutting my beard in order to blend in a little bit more. So I was young, first couple of years with the company. I go out, cut my beard, cut my mustache, and I'll never forget, I looked in the mirror after I did it, and I never felt more lost in myself than that point. And I said, you know what, from here on, I'm going to try my hardest not to try to blend in, but to be myself. So that was really the start of a pivot to first me realizing that this thing wasn't necessarily working in my favor anymore and that I needed to get some place where it actually was.
Wow. That is real. That is very real. Yeah. And, I'm sorry that you had to go through that, but I think it was a great learning experience, right? I think all too often we have these seminal experiences in our life where we see how we're different and we feel our otherness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just to share a personal story of mine, I felt my otherness when I first joined Teach for America. You know, I went to HBCU as well, right up the street from you, Winston-Salem State University.
Everybody knows Winston-Salem, it's okay.
And you know, it wasn't until I joined Teach for America and moved to Atlanta for the summer, and I was surrounded by, you know, we brought in 150 core members into Charlotte. This was back in 2008. And I think about 15 of us total may have been people of color. That's across all spectrums. And I was never surrounded as much by people who didn't look like me. I think I grew up in a pretty diverse area. And I think about school, you know, even though I went to an HBCU, we had people of all nationalities there.
Right.
But going to Teach for America, living in Atlanta over the summer, being surrounded by that. And then it wasn't just color either. You know, I don't know about you, Donald, but I grew up in a lower income family, right? So it wasn't like my family, we were making a lot of money. And I think, like, I also felt my otherness, and it was exacerbated by class, right? Because, you know, I was struggling. As a teacher, we didn't get paid to the end of August. So I had to survive June, July, and through August, right? Get somewhere to live, put a down payment, a deposit on a place to live. Luckily, I had a vehicle, but all the things that come along with starting a new life and moving to a new city, I had to do that, not getting paid until the end of August. So
right. The
class was that was also a big issue. You talked about something that you know I experienced, and you know. I think what that young lady, your mentor, who spoke to you about cutting your beard, I think that that could be considered a microaggression, you know? And when we think about, like, microaggressions, we know that they're real. I think that they're not always immediately apparent to others, right? Like, we might not know that, oh, we have to take a step back and reflect and say, wow, like, this really happened, and this is a byproduct of that. Can you think of another maybe a microaggression that you experienced while working in, you know, in this field? Because you work in an area, in a field that, as you stated earlier, is not occupied by a lot of people who look like us. So I imagine you may have experienced some others. Can you think of another microaggression or another opportunity where you felt like something happened that wasn't right? Maybe it was perpetuated against you by someone who was not a person of color. Have you experienced any things that made you, like, stop and think, wow, this just isn't right?
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. You know, the first one I think was rough because it was somebody who looked like me. I think the
right.
other scenario, you know, I wasn't surprised by it, but it happened, and I think I was able to move on a little bit more quickly because it wasn't that person. But this actually came in one of my entrepreneurial endeavors, my previous startup. So about 3-4 years ago, I was in the process of, I launched a startup. I was in the process of raising money for said startup. I'm still in the Washington, D.C. area. I was attempting to raise money from what they call angel investors. These are typically wealthy individuals. You can think income $250,000 or above. They either work for a company, sold that company, made money, but they basically make a living investing in small companies in the very early stages. Watch those companies grow. When those companies exit, they take some money and they get rich. That's pretty much how that cycle works. Well, this particular investor, we were having a couple of conversations. The first one went pretty well. I was starting to fill him out. I was feeling real good. And then we had a follow-up discussion. And his question was, he said, hey, you know, I ask everyone this, which I didn't believe, but he said, I'm going to ask you a series of questions. It might feel weird, but I have to ask them anyway. And he proceeds to ask me what the occupations of my mother and my father were. And then he asked me if my mother and father both had like the highest education, like did they have college degrees or not? And I said, you know, actually, yeah, my mom graduated college. I said, but my father dropped out of middle school to take care of his 4 siblings. So no college degree. And in short, you know, he and I didn't talk too much after that. I think he ghosted me pretty shortly after that. But it was one of those times where, you know, I certainly recognize that people have to do due diligence in finding out about the backgrounds of people. But to have someone ask me if my parents had a college degree and why that mattered, what I was working on, I couldn't point to anything else other than me being an African-American male, and he probably hadn't had come across too many people like me before. So he wanted to make sure he wasn't investing in someone that he couldn't necessarily believe in. But that was definitely a time where, you know, rubbed me the wrong way, but it taught me, like, you know, at the end of the day, you can be as smart and as qualified as you want, but there's still going to be a point in time where you might need to depend on someone else to get where you are. And when those people don't look like you, it just makes it a little bit harder for you to relate and for you to be a known quantity to them. And if they can't put a label on you, if you don't look like the definitions of success that they've come to recognize, i.e. white males, Jack Dorsey, CEO of Twitter, Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Facebook, Elon Musk, CEO of Tesla, so on and so forth, the majority of the companies. If you don't come from that cookie cutter image, they have issues getting behind you. And there was not a time more prescient than that one that I felt in the process of raising money. And shortly after that, I sort of ended my bout with the fundraising process just out of sheer frustration, to be honest.
Wow. You know, Donald, we've known each other, full disclosure. We've known each other, what, since 2006?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We've known each other since 2006. And,
13
you know,
years.
You learn something new each and every day. It's amazing how similar our stories are. And I say that because my mother, 14 siblings, and she dropped out of high school. She dropped out in ninth grade. My mother picked cotton. Yeah, she picked cotton. She the second oldest, and she dropped out to help my grandmother pick cotton and take care, pardon me, of the family. And, you know, unbeknownst to me, you know, my father, he passed away, he's deceased. But I just found out last week that my father also dropped out of high school. And both of them went back and received their, you know, they went back and went to night school and received their diplomas. And, you know, my father went on to pursue some college. However, like, it's just amazing that this occurred, right? Like, we live two, you know, we live, like, several states away. But the journey, right? The journey.
Almost the same life, right?
Almost the same life. And so, you know, hearing that investor ask and inquire about, you know, your parents' journey, wow, that was a major microaggression. And, you know, I can imagine, and you speaking about how difficult it is, we always have to go the extra mile. And one of the reasons we're having this conversation and this podcast was started is because there are people who will listen to this, who look like you and I, who don't understand that, right? They don't get it. They're frustrated. And I want them to know for a fact that you're not the only one, that other people have walked this path before. And I want this podcast to be a mode of connecting them to individuals who are currently walking the path, who have walked the path, and let them know that, like, this too will pass. Like, you will be able to get through this. You will still be successful. So I appreciate you. I appreciate you sharing that. And I want to transition a little bit, because I think we're getting to this point in the conversation where we talk about, like, that feeling. We talked about that feeling of otherness. We talked about what you just experienced with the angel investor. I know you live in Seattle, and I just want to ask you, like, you know, you've navigated being the only person of color in a room, I can imagine, probably your entire career, right? This isn't nothing new to you.
Definitely.
So how do you do that? What if you could talk to that young man, that young lady, who's currently waking up every morning, going to work, and not seeing anyone who looks like her or him, what would you say to them? What tips can you give them on how to navigate that? How do you handle it?
I think first and foremost, I think you have to seek people. You have to seek out someone that either looks like you, that you can relate to, or someone that you can aspire to be. There's this thing that, you know, children or people can't aspire to something that they can't see. And I think it's extremely important to be able to do that, to identify people, if it's a mentor, if it's someone online, especially in today's climate and world, it's a lot easier to bridge networks and close those gaps to people. And you'd be surprised at the people that you'll reach out to who you may think don't appear to be accessible. But if you just reached out via email, via phone call, if they're listening to this podcast, there's definitely an opportunity to reach out to those types of people in similar fields, and people will be happy. We'll bend over backwards to certainly pull you along. I think the second thing is having the confidence that you are enough. I think, and your background is enough, and your education is enough. I think for too long, I went not doubting. I've always been a confident guy, but there was certainly a period in my career very early where I didn't know if my education and my background was going to be adequate enough. I thought, you know, I went to an HBCU. It was definitely the first choice. It was the only place that I applied to and the only place that I wanted to go. So I was never not confident in that decision. But once I started to get into the room with other interns, of course, you know, if there's a person across from you who went to UT Austin, there's someone else from MIT, there's someone else from UCLA, you start to, and they've never heard of your school, it's only natural to wonder whether or not your education is adequate enough. And then over the course of these summers, I would learn, not only am I just as smart, but I'm better than these people as well. And, you know, it was that initial confidence boost. Like, man, it doesn't matter. You know, and whoever you put me up against, I'm extremely confident that I'll be just as, if not smarter than those people. And that's the confidence that I carry with me throughout my career. And I continue to carry that, you know, presence that if I walk into the room, it doesn't matter what they look like, it doesn't matter their background, I know for sure that they haven't overcome as much as I have. And that alone makes me, I think, more qualified for whatever I'm trying to go after. And the third thing I would probably say is to seek out some allies, some people that may not look like you, but some people that can understand whose stories resonate with you, some people who can identify with some of the challenges that you go through being a minority. You know, color isn't the only minority. Obviously, women, you know, go through a lot of the same things. The LGBTQ community go through extremely similar things. So finding those people who have a very similar walk to the one that you have and go through very similar struggles can also be helpful. And being able to turn to someone and say, man, I experienced this today in this way, and theirs may be different, but they may say, yep, you know, someone looked at me a certain way because they found out that I was pregnant, or they found out that I was gay, or that I have a husband at home and I'm a guy. You know, so those types of things definitely happen outside of race as well. But those would probably be the top three things that I would lean on.
That is, I think that those are solid recommendations. The biggest one, in my opinion, and it's something that I tell my kids, I tell my daughters, is that you are enough. And to be very transparent with you, I think that that is something that us individuals who navigate this journey of being the few or the only one who looks like us in this journey, like, that's something that we have to all go through, that feeling of, like, do I really belong here? Yeah. And I want to say to individuals listening to this, like, you will experience that. You know, it's inevitable. When you walk into places and, you know, you see no melanin, right, or –
mm-hmm.
People, like you said, people go to schools and they don't even know that your school exists. They've never heard of it. You begin to question, like, do I really belong? But one thing I will say, as a proud product of an HBCU, excuse me, is that, like, I found that, like, my education and the quality of education I receive, it's up to snuff, right? Like, it stands. I can stand beside anyone and do the work. I can, you know. So that's one thing that I will say to people, that you do belong. And I think also, 100 Black Men, like, they have this saying, and I don't know if it's their official motto, but it's like you be what you see, right? Right. And so, like, if you don't see it, if you never see it, you don't know you can do it. And
right,
I think this is, yeah, so, like, I think about that a lot. So that is absolutely correct. But you brought up something that I think is exceptionally important, and it's a great transition to my next question. I would love to hear you. Just you talked about allies. And one thing that I say to everyone who listens to this is that Revel 1851 is for all people, right? It's for all people. We want people of color to know that they're not the only one experiencing microaggressions and otherness and potential loneliness at work. But we also want those who identify with majority culture to understand and have an opportunity to hear what their coworkers experience daily and hopefully develop strategies to become allies for them. So you talked about, like, one thing that they can do, a solid tip is to go find an ally, find someone that you can confide in, that you can grow, that can help you grow. So can you tell us about a time where you found an unexpected ally, or maybe you had a colleague show up for you, and what that looked like?
Sure. There's definitely one that pops out, and it was probably the most surprising bond that I never knew, and I never thought that I would have, definitely as a Black guy. You know, growing up in the area that I grew up, it was one of these, you know, hostile, over-masculine types of places where people look down upon people, especially, you know, anyone that didn't look like them, or anyone who had a different sexual orientation. So sort of, you know, growing up, there was always this sensitivity to to gay people. And there was this, idea that something was wrong with you. And that's just the way that, you know, very ignorant as kids, you grow up in an atmosphere like that. And I'll never forget maybe 4 or 5 years into my career. And, you know, all throughout high school and college, I, of course, had friends that were members of that community and had really close friends. But I never had any gay male friends, like really good friends. And one of the first direct reports that I had when I was working at ExxonMobil was a gay guy. And, you know, I knew we had some stuff in common, really cool, it was really laid back. We were from the same area. So I liked them a lot. And it was only then when we started talking about some of the experiences that we had with diversity in the workplace and some of the things or some of the ways that we were impacted adversely by discrimination. And he showed me a map. Not just of the U.S., but it was a map of the entire world, and it showed the hostility towards the LGBTQ community in wow. places. And, you know, if you looked at Africa, it was like deep red, meaning that for some people, visiting some of these hostile countries meant losing your life. So there was like literally a fear that you would lose your life if you were open. So it was one of those things that he never struggled with. He was completely open, but I was able to confide with him with my thoughts and my experiences as a black man being discriminated against. And he was in a workforce where it was an extremely conservative Christian-based culture where it was certainly frowned upon to be openly gay. And it was something that he never struggled with. He was certainly proud in, but he knew people that were just like him that were, you know, still remained with that secret and weren't comfortable coming out for the reasons that we talked about. But it was one of those relationships where we hit it off from there and really became really good friends. And I confided in him, he confided in me. But if you had asked me, you know, 20 years prior when I was, you know, just a kid and she wasn't, if he would be one of my best friends, I would have told you no. But it's one of those things where definitely love that guy. It was an awesome friendship. It continues to be. And he's definitely been supportive of me and vice versa throughout our careers.
Man, that's amazing. That's amazing. I think that as we grow, there's a quote, and I'm going to paraphrase it, that the purpose of education is like to teach you to think, right? Man, Donald, you know, like I said, I literally just said how we knew each other, but I too grew up in that same environment, right, mm-hmm. where words that were hurtful were consistently used. And, you know, growing up, like, I don't think I had the lexicon, right, or the knowledge to know or the vocabulary to, like, clearly articulate that, hey, this isn't right. But I think also, like, growing up, And learning new things and like experiencing different people and cultures showed me very quickly, you know, that, hey, like my view of the world is one that's very small, right? And a lot of people, I grew up in a small town, and sometimes our thoughts and how we look at things can be influenced by growing up in a small town. So that's a powerful story, man. That's a powerful story. I think about my own journey and unexpected allies. You know, I think it's important for people to be transparent, right? When mm-hmm. I moved to Dallas-Fort Worth for a job, and I moved there sight unseen. And I had just finished working on President Obama's campaign. I dropped out of college, grad school, to join the campaign because I really and truly believed and President Obama and what he was trying to do for our country. And so I dropped out of college, dropped out of grad school, moved to North Carolina, worked on the campaign, came back, finished grad school. But I thought that I would get a job on the campaign, in the administration. I really and truly thought that I was going to do that. But it was, 2012, and the economy was still bad, and people who were in administration jobs from 2008, they didn't leave. So there were very few jobs. Yeah. And so I was in grad school, but I was unemployed. And I'll never forget, I finished school and I got a job in Dallas, but I had to move to Dallas. And my mother emptied out. You know, I had a little bit of money that I had saved up, but I was still living in D.C. without a job, so having to pay rent and all of that. So my savings was depleted, but my mother emptied out her account to help me move to Dallas. And I moved to Dallas, joined Teach for America, and I worked for a woman by the name of Lacey, and I call her L Bug, and L Bug was my unexpected ally, right? And so what people don't know, a lot of people don't know, is I lived in an extended stay for 6 months.
Oh, wow.
Six months. Part of the reason was, Dallas was a hard place to live as an African-American man. You know, even at the job in Texas and Dallas, initially that first year, I was the only one there. And if I wanted to see people who looked like me, I could go look at the janitor and talk to the gentleman who shined shoes. You know, our office was downtown Dallas in the heart of the city. And very few, from my experience, things could have changed by now, but very few people of color actually live in the city of Dallas. A lot of them live in, like, Cedar Hill, DeSoto, in, like, neighboring cities and suburbs. So I very rarely
saw. But not Dallas proper.
No, definitely not Dallas proper. So I very rarely saw people who looked like me. But Lacey, I never forget. Like, Lacey, like, I could talk to her. You know what I mean? She understood it. And even if she didn't understand, she was able to empathize. And she made me feel like I belonged. You know, she made me feel, even when I wanted to quit, because it was hard, and I was an entire time zone away from my family, I found in her someone I could confide in when things got hard, when, you know, like even with the job. So she really made that transition to Dallas easy. And, like, in terms of difficult conversations about race and about class, she stood on the right side, right? She stood on the right side of history. And sometimes it was hard, but she stood up and she made her voice heard. And I think that's what we need. And so when we think about allies and what we want our people to do who come behind us, we want you, people who are listening to this, we want you to find those. And it's going to be difficult. It may be difficult, but once you find them, hold on to them and cultivate that relationship. Because it's important. I want to shift the conversation one more time. Donald, talk to us about your new foray into this entrepreneurial world with Boxed Up. What is Boxed Up, and how can people connect with it?
Definitely, man. I call it, or I've been dubbing it, Boxed Up, like the Amazon, but for rentals. It's really your passion in a box. So if you're an entrepreneur, if you're a business, if you're an individual, and you're looking to start something new, whether it's recording your first podcast, doing something like taking up drone photography, or if you need some construction equipment this weekend and you don't have something, you can come to Boxed Up. You can select your rental dates. We'll ship the product out to your home in a box. You unbox it. So we'll put together kits for you to make things extremely easy for you to take up and pick up anything that you're looking to do. And once you're finished with it, you just simply box it back up and then ship it out. So I really want to take the barrier of entry out for doing a lot of the things. I think in today's climate, the level of content that people are really looking for, if it's a website, if it's imagery online, if it's your Instagram, you know, everything is high res. The content is extremely high quality, but it costs money to do those things, and it costs money to start a business. And, you know, I didn't want people to feel left out or feel like they couldn't start working on what it is that they were that they wanted to work on because they didn't have enough money to do so. So we make it easy for businesses and for people to get started doing whatever it is that they're passionate about.
Wow. That is, how did you come up with that idea?
Yeah, it was a mix. I'd be lying if I said it was all me, but the first time I stumbled across the concept was, I spoke about my mom before and sort of the impact that she had on my life. Well, when I got out of school, I lived with my mom for a few years, and I wanted to do something really, really nice for her. And I said, you know what, I'm going to decide to renovate my basement, and renovate my living room and renovate her living room and renovate the basement that I was living in. So I decided to literally from scratch take her completely unfinished basement. I bought all these tools, all these materials, and really gave her a brand new basement in the first floor of her home. I mean, you know, sanded down the wood floors, ripped up the carpet, polished the floors, new ceilings, new walls, new paint job. I mean, you name it, I did it from start to finish. But at the end of that project, I had all this stuff that I was left over with. And I'm like, I will never use this stuff again in my life. I wish I could lend it out to someone and maybe try to earn some money. And even in the process, half the stuff that I bought, I really didn't want to own it. I just needed it for the job that I wanted to do, but I couldn't find anywhere to rent it from. So that idea sort of started as a spark in my head back in 2012, and it really never left. And, you know, life, it's funny how life works. Life continues to go on. And I had a friend of mine, he was in L.A., and he's like, Boone, there's this awesome opportunity for people to rent cameras, to rent hard drives within Hollywood. Like, nothing like this exists. There's something, there's a big box rental store, and then there are these companies or people that you can rent from. But there's nobody in between that's really doing that. I said, man, you know, I'm really not sure if I'm really sold on it. But it wasn't until I started to spend some time at Amazon looking at the business model and learning from that industry. And I had a customer come out and say, hey, do you guys offer anything like this? And I said, well, no, we don't, but it's definitely something that we should consider. And then the spark went off in my head is, you know, there are all of these areas in my life and all of these signs that I haven't really been paying attention to. And I'd asked God, I said, God, I don't know what it is that you want me to do, but just, you know, order my steps and show me what it is that I need to be doing. And it's funny how things work, man. Things just sort of came in alignment, and it was right there in front of me, and it had been the entire time for at least 5 years. But I think I'd finally gone through enough in other places and learned enough throughout my journey that it was time for me to actually dive deep on this specific one. So from the time that the idea hit me and I started jotting down notes to the time that I actually launched it, it took me about 102 days, just over 100 days from inception to launch.
I saw, if I'm correct, let me know if I'm wrong, but you created some sort of like manual, book, some sort of guide how to go from 0 to 100 days and create a small business, right?
I did. I recently wrote a post on Medium just about that, just kind of overcoming the fear, this analysis paralysis that all entrepreneurs go through and that people go through. I mean, even if it's not, you know, being an entrepreneur, someone who's jumping into a new field. Yep, I wrote a step-by-step guide. I've done it a few times, unsuccessfully, unfortunately, or it'd be my full-time job right now. But I've done it enough to go through a series of steps to understand these are all of the things that you need to do in order to get your business off the ground. And there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to do it and do it quickly. You know, there's this concept of failing fast, meaning launch, get your product out there, don't overthink it because you want to get it in the customer's hands. You want to understand the customer experience so you can work backward and develop the best customer experience that people will want and that people will buy for. And if it just sits in your head for months and years, it'll turn into something that people may or may not want. You really won't know until you get it out there. So I wanted to create that guide to take some of the misnomers and some of the things that may or may not be true out of it, so people can have a guide to walk you through on how to launch their business.
Oh, certainly. I think that's super important to have. So
certainly, for sure.
Jay-Z has this quote,
and
it really resonates with me. And I would love to hear two things from you. Thing number one, let me read the quote first. You know, I can't help the poor if I'm one of them. So I got rich and gave back. And to me, that's the win-win. How have you navigated something that I have to imagine? And maybe you haven't went through this, but I can imagine you have. How have you navigated the pressures that come with being a successful black man and giving back to the community and doing things to give back to the community, right? With, like, working maybe in the private sector or like, how have you navigated that? Because sometimes people feel this intense pressure once they make it, right? It's like the one, you know, out of your friend group who makes it, you know, makes it, and I'm putting those words in air quotes. How do you navigate that? Yeah, how do you navigate
that? I think for the first couple of years, I felt like I carried the entire black race on my shoulders when I walked into a meeting. We talked about being alone. For sure, I used to walk into places and felt like I'm the only one. I have to kill this presentation. I have to kill this discussion because they're looking at me. They're looking at AMT. They're looking at every black person that will ever come along in the room. And I used to build all of this pressure up, and it really made it tough for me to get past that. But I think once I dealt with that, the pressure really went away, and I really didn't think about it nearly as much in those terms. But to your point, I definitely wanted to find a way to get back. And really the biggest way that I've been able to do that, obviously being transparent in my entrepreneurial endeavors and making sure, you mentioned a Jay-Z quote. I have a favorite Jay-Z quote as well. I actually wrote it in that piece. And it goes, like I told you to sell drugs. No, Hov did that. So hopefully you won't have to go through that. And that verse basically says, like, no, I did this, so you won't have to do it. Follow my steps. And that's exactly what that article was. But the second way is with getting people jobs. I've been very lucky and fortunate to end up at the companies and the positions that I have. And I've always wanted to strive to find a way, to give back to people and to get people jobs. I always had this mindset that people, that companies would hire tons and tons of graduates of A&T if only they knew how amazing the school was. And I'm not in recruiting, but from the day I landed at my former company, ExxonMobil, and since I landed at Amazon, I've been going back in recruiting capacities to go back, drum up interest in recruiting, not just at A&T, but at all HBCUs to say, hey, there are people of color that are talented, that are smart, and that can do everything that everybody else in this company is doing. You just need to go out and give them a chance. You may not know that they exist, but they do. And I'm super, super proud that this year I was able, alongside a former colleague of mine, Brittany Hicks, able to raise funds from multiple organizations throughout Amazon and build enough interest to go back and support our endeavors to launch a really a sort of a university-wide recruiting program between Amazon and North Carolina A&T. So something that I've been really proud of this year.
Man, that's amazing. So it looks like you are killing it on both ends. I know that it has to be difficult being a father, being a husband, a full-time job, as well as, you know, entrepreneurial spirit and getting this company off the ground. So I want to thank you for giving us the time today to talk to you. Want to thank you so much because there are people who will listen to this who need to hear what you have to say, who will feel inspired, who will know that they can carry on because you're carrying on. So
thank my wife as well. She's the backbone. As you know, you can't do anything without the support of a significant other. So even, you know, making time for things like this podcast, she was able to help out with. So special thanks to her too. AJ, I love you. Thank you.
Absolutely.
You got to get some. You got to get them brownie points when you can.
You got to get those brownie points when you can. That is so real. You know, let me just throw my wife out there. Thank you, baby, because you are the best. Like I said, thank you again for your time. Is there any final words, anything you'd like to say to everyone on the line and who will listen to this?
I think we covered a lot, but I won't make up any quotes, but I will say, you know, life is short, and in the grand scheme of things, I heard this on a podcast I was actually listening to not too long ago. Said in the grand scheme of things, your life is essentially the blink of an eye, and you know you'll pass and you'll perish from this earth before you know it. So make sure you take every second to squeeze everything that you can out of life, if that's being present in the day, if that's taking advantage and acting on an idea that's been in your head that you have for a business, whatever it is. We always think that we have a lot of time to accomplish these grandiose things, but in the grand scheme of things, it'll be over before you know it. So just enjoy the ride while you can, have fun, take risk, and the rest will figure itself out.
Thanks for listening to the Black Work Experience Podcast. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review us. If you would like to hear more, follow us on IG at BWEP. We're also on Twitter at BWE Podcast. Black Work Experience is hosted and produced by me, Robert Stevens. Our show is mixed by strategic communication specialist Sarah Daggett. Find out more about her amazing work at DaggettConsultingLLC.com. That's Daggett, DAGGETT, consultingllc.com. Our theme music was composed by Cameron Wright. If you would like to contribute to Mail Time, please submit your mail times on our IG at BWE Pod. You can also DM us on Twitter at BWE Podcast or via email at blackworkexperiencepod@gmail.com.